Greetings. Welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. Today I am joined by Robert Biswas-Diener, and we're going to be talking about his book, Positive Provocation, 25 Questions to Elevate Your Coaching Practice. I really enjoyed reading this book and felt provoked. Actually, it did deepen my thinking. So we're going to be getting into the different provocations inside of the book, such as why is it so hard to be a great coach? Is coaching non-directive? What if coaches had agendas? Why do we dislike self-disclosure? And why aren't we better at observing coaching? A few more things about Robert. He is widely known as the Indiana Jones of positive psychology because his research has taken him to far-flung places such as Greenland, India, Kenya, and Israel. He's a leading authority on strengths, culture, courage, and happiness, and known for his pioneering work in the application of positive psychology to coaching. He's authored more than 60 peer-reviewed academic articles, and as I've mentioned, is the author of this book, Positive Provocation. So that all being said, let's dive in. All right, Robert, it's great to be with you. I'm excited about our conversation today. How are you doing, first of all?
Doing great. Thanks for asking. How are you?
Well, you know, you just mentioned as we were checking in that you were appreciating this kind of conversation. You've got a lot of meetings coming up, but you know, you don't have to prepare, or maybe there's a certain kind of feeling that comes with engaging in a podcast. And I have that feeling too. Like, I just love the feeling of not knowing exactly where we're going to end up around a topic that I really love, coaching. So yeah, I'm doing good.
And there's an obvious parallel to coaching itself, right? That sure, there's a structure. Sure, it's high stakes. The stuff you're talking about matters. And yet it's highly improvisational. You're in the moment. You go where there's energy. And that's what I'm hoping for this conversation as well.
Well, I think that's a beautiful kind of illustration of what I think we'll get into today is these kind of polarities that we might experience, or these paradoxes in coaching that you're pointing out. I've been reading your book today, Positive Provocation. And so that would be, I think, the main kind of structure or focus of our conversation. But I'm sure we'll, as I always do, get off into the weeds in places. So, and I just wanted to actually begin by starting with a question which I actually had kind of took from your book. And I thought, I'll ask Robert this. So I've got two, actually. One of them is, what new approach to coaching or personal discovery has challenged your accepted wisdom about what coaching is in the past year or two? I'll stop there. I'll let you answer that one first.
Yeah. Start with something giant. I love it.
Just put you on the spot.
What exactly is coaching anyway? I mean, I think it's a great question, and I kind of think it's something that we should all be asking ourselves on an ongoing basis. I feel very lucky that I have a network of very thoughtful and very experienced coaches. So, you know, kind of famous coaches, people you would have heard of, but they're asking these same kinds of questions, and they're saying, you know, what counts as coaching? Like, is coaching partly being a friend to a person? Like, is there overlap? And, you know, and in some ways, you know, if you were in a coach training program, that would be anathema. Like, obviously we're not supposed to be friends. It's a professional relationship, but what constitutes friendship? And are you bringing some of that quality in? So I'm just always sort of wrestling with those types of questions, which means that my belief in my own coaching is inherently porous. That is, it's not rigid. So I love also watching people coach who coach in a very different way than me. I just saw Marshall Reynolds coach not that long ago. I think she's an extraordinarily skilled coach. And her style is just very, very different than mine. I mean, she asks people about obstacles and wants to focus on problems and negative thinking. And that's very common in coaching, but it's just very different than my approach. I don't think my approach is better than hers. But when you see someone who's so good at something, who's doing it differently than you, I think you have to say, like, well, do I have it figured out? Like, is there something I can learn from her? Is there something I can adopt or try out? Is it worth me experimenting in my own practice with that type of thing? So That is one example, I think, is just, is there utility in focusing a little bit more on some of the negative obstacle kind of stuff, which is something I pretty naturally avoid.
Yeah. That brings up a question I've been playing around with, which is the value in challenging one's sense of what it is to be a coach, or reimagining what that is to bring yourself to your coaching edge. And what I mean by that is that, like, I notice that I'll get some new idea will come in. I'll meet a coaching teacher, and I'll get really inspired by them. I'll learn a lot from them, kind of absorb that into my coaching. It will transform and deepen my coaching. And then after, I don't know how long, 2, 3 years, I kind of get complacent, or I just feel like I'm not on my edge anymore. In some ways, all coaches are continually refining their edge, but I have these big leaps sometimes. So I don't know if you relate to that and what it brings up.
Very much so. I am thrilled to hear you say that because I think it's exactly the kind of conversation that coaching needs in general. I mean, my take on coaching culture is that everyone has a mindfulness practice, everyone is self-aware, everyone's put together, everyone has the golden tongue and is helping their clients. And I just feel like to some extent that's a veneer that doesn't help us. I want to hear, "Oh, I plateaued for a while without growing." Or, "I made a mistake that was like a total rookie mistake, and I'm kind of wrestling with that." Or, I offended my client one time. I took a risk and it actually offended them." Like that, like those are pretty interesting moments worth talking about because we're all talking about the good stuff. So I just want to acknowledge that it's so cool to hear you say that you plateau, because I think we're all in danger of plateauing. And I think it is a little Pollyanna-ish to just suggest, "Oh no, we're always constantly engaged in continuous growth and there's never a static moment." Yeah, of course there are. I had huge periods where I plateaued. And I think I plateaued longer than you. I don't think I just take a class from someone and I'm like, "Oh, I'm just immediately ready to integrate that into my coaching." So I think it's a natural tendency. Sorry, I'm kind of talking a lot around this, but when I think about sort of good coaches to great coaches, some of the elements that I personally just think make for great coaches is one, that kind of admission that you don't have it figured out. The humility that comes with, "Well, there is some uncertainty. I am asking, what are the boundaries of coaching? I am asking when I get it wrong. I am asking if I'm leaning too hard into a particular professional habit and I'm on autopilot. Am I engaged enough?" And I think that's a not only an important, but a crucial part of the development of mastery.
Yeah, it just seems like we part of learning, doesn't it? Like you come across a way of coaching or being or a value, and then that it's kind of fresh and you want to play with it, and there's a kind of learning cycle around that, and then it can become habituated, which is also good because you're able to maybe take on new things, but in that habituation process, there can be a kind of complacency or a feeling that sets in of like I just started to get a bit bored. I was like, man, I'm that shouldn't I was kind of bored from that session. What's going on there?
It kind of, I think, related to this is a pretty sticky question of how long should your coaching engagement with any individual client be? And I've recently asked a bunch of people this. And of course, coaches want to say it depends, which is the least satisfying answer in the world, unless you can articulate exactly what it depends upon, right? Otherwise, it's just a wishy-washy answer. So I think there's a real argument to be made for having the coaching engagement be as short as possible. One reason is you help the client with minimal intervention. It's easier on their pocketbook, but also it does shield them from the type of complacency that I do think is a sort of a natural human habit. My own experience with it is the longer I coach with someone, the more I'm a bit lazy in my coaching. Like, oh, well, I can kind of set a pretty soft agenda here. We're just friends, or it's okay if this doesn't work out, or I could cut a corner there. And I can just feel those temptations arising. And I admit to them. I endeavor not to give in to them, but I do think that they're there.
Yeah. I mean, just to build on that, how do you respond to that if you notice? Because I think many coaches listening might recognize that where, you know, you become familiar with a client and then that affords that possibility you describe. Like, how do you respond to that? Do you just have super short coaching engagements, or do you reflect and adjust? Or
yeah, in part, one of the things I talk about when I first meet with a prospective client is the shortness factor, that I do want to work with them as short as possible. And that's harder for me in terms of business because, you know, it means I'm having shorter engagements. There's more client turnover. And I don't want it to be short, like two sessions, because I'm actually not sure that that really helps a client in terms of making substantive change, right? That would be pretty quick. But I rarely have a client that's sort of a year long, right? I have a lot of sort of 3 month clients, which feels kind of like a sweet spot for me. But for some of those who are longer engagements, 6 months, 8 months, whatever it is, I have to remind myself of what we're talking about. And so sometimes I'll just spend time prepping for a session by thinking about, what is it that I was originally attracted to in this client? Like, what is it that I so respect about them? What are the strengths they have? What do they bring to the table that I wish I could bring to the table? And that just sort of lights a fire under me to do right by them.
Yeah, that's, I want to kind of bookmark, because I can feel my desire to ask you about your coaching and what you do. We'll get into that thing, but I just want to ask the other question that I had. And I think you kind of touched into this, but what ways do you think the coaching community at large needs to provoke itself at the moment? You know, I was thinking about AI coming in. You know, that's a huge provocative topic.
Yeah, look, this is going to sound so pejorative, so my apologies to your listeners right up front. I love coaching, and I think the people who are attracted to coaching are service-oriented. They're pretty well put together. I think they're pretty great, really. They're very positive. And I am often surprised by how much dogmatism there is in our profession. Which you would think, for people who are like, let's embrace uncertainty, everything is a learning experience, that there'd be a relative lack of dogmatism. And yet I hear people, I came out of X training school and we've figured it out and this is exactly the way to do it. And I've got my formula, or I give this assessment to absolutely every single client, no matter what, because I know it works. And I'm surprised by that, to be honest. So, you know, in part, the book you mentioned, Positive Provocation, was sort of my rejoinder to that, which is, shouldn't we be asking ourselves the same types of broad, challenging questions that we're asking our clients? Shouldn't we just be getting under the hood and asking some fundamental things like, do you as a coach have any type of agenda whatsoever? Is beginner's mind the only way to approach things? You know, what if we did believe in shoulds? What are the benefits of shoulds? You know, I mean, the list just goes on and on. I mean, you could create 100 questions like these that I think would prevent, or at least kind of guard against, dogmatism and just re-engage people with their own practice.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, let's dive in, because I really appreciate reading your book. And I found myself really, what I really like about it as well is the reflections at the end of each of the chapters, and really great reflections. So, but maybe we could just move through some of the provocations in there. And maybe, though, it might be good to ask, what do you mean by positive provocation first?
Sure. So I've always been wired a little bit differently. You know, I have a sort of a natural tendency towards devil's advocacy, a little bit of kind of counterpoint thinking, but hopefully not in a jerky way. Like, I'm not just here to challenge you. I don't want to pull the rug out from under you, say everything you know is wrong, and me, Robert, the enlightened one, I know the truth. Because I don't think that's helpful to anyone, nor do I believe it to be true. What I do think is that to provoke means to bring in something fresh that you haven't thought of, but that's something substantive, right? I can't say, what if the change process is best activated by calling upon alien beings, right? Like, that's a really fresh thought, but it's completely without usable merit, right? So it's not really provocative. It's just a bit weird, right? Just a bit out there. So instead, you want to challenge something. So I want to say something fresh, but I want to say it with some meat, some substance to it. And if you're open to considering it, I don't care where you end up. So if I say, do you believe in shoulds? Let's just use that as a quick example. You know, coaches say, oh, I don't believe in shoulds. And what they typically mean is people are a bit hard on themselves. And yet, if you look culturally, every culture in the world believes in duty, loyalty, obligation, a whole web of connection to other people, fulfilling your role. All of those are shoulds. You know, if someone is struck by a car in front of you, you probably should help them. You should render aid, you know, and those should seem quite okay. So then the question is just, why don't you just think through shoulds? So instead of just saying, I don't believe in shoulds, this kind of pat platitude, why don't you instead think through, how do shoulds work for us? How do shoulds work against us? What are the limitations of shoulds? What are the benefits of shoulds? And as I think about that, how might that affect my coaching? How might I be projecting my own assumptions via my questions to the client or my comments or acknowledgements to the client? And I don't care if people agree with me or disagree with me, because I don't even know if I'm right about this stuff. I'm just like, let's just ask about shoulds. I'm not making a strong claim that you have to believe one way or the other. So that's sort of what I mean by positive provocation.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hear in what you're saying there that there's like a, you know, a kind of let's reflect on some of these axioms of coaching, you know, these tenets of coaching and just see what comes from that reflection, you know, that they afford a certain kind of possibility inside of what coaching is. And, you know, they were formulated in a particular moment and maybe they weren't. Like, I like what you said about, like, when you looked for, we shouldn't ask why, you know, and when you look back and you couldn't find, there was no source for that kind of myth in coaching. Like, no, none of the coaching teachers were saying that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think people who've been around coaching for a while are probably familiar with that axiom. Don't ask why. And typically, there are several reasons given. One is that it could sound demeaning, dismissive, challenging, like, why on earth would you do that? But as far as I know, no coaches are asking that kind of question, right? And so if that's the rationale, well, I think that could easily be fixed with tone, right? Oh, I'm thinking about taking a job in London. Oh, why that job? I mean, I don't think your client's going to react negatively or feel, you know, too invalidated by that type of curious tone. Why could potentially ask for the client to come up with sort of an artificial, contrived reason that's a simplification, because there's probably many reasons why, and they might just grab the reason that's most salient to them. But even that might be helpful information for the coaching conversation. To credit Ian Day in England, he looked at the writing of all these thought leaders in coaching, and there's just not really any good evidence that any of the pioneers of coaching strongly said, don't ask why. I mean, some of them said, oh yeah, be cautious about your tone when you ask why, but none of them were like, don't ask for your client's rationale, values, or thinking, which is kind of what comes out with why. So rather than just buy into don't ask why, it's like, well, when should we ask why? When shouldn't we? How should we ask why? How shouldn't we? And that, to me, just becomes a far richer conversation.
I think Ian Day, and maybe he had a co-writer on the book about challenging coaching.
That's right.
We actually had a conversation years ago, and I really appreciated where they were coming from. So maybe this points to another kind of provocation, and you know, the place for challenging or provoking. I mean, maybe provoking is a different question. I was going to ask, like, is there a place for provoking clients? But yeah, just kind of bringing in challenge to clients, because I think coaching, as you've been articulated, can lean on the side of being, you know, following the client's agenda, being non-directive, empathy, listening. So it kind of has a particular flavor to it. So yeah, well, yeah, could you speak into that?
If we think about challenge existing on a continuum, and maybe challenge is a pretty benign phenomenon, let's say that it requires efforts, it's a bit difficult. You know, so climbing up stairs two at a time might be challenging. You know, I mean, but no one would say that's a bad thing to do, or we should never seek to do that, or, you know, that's sort of morally wrong. And I think challenge is the same thing. When you ask a client something like, what's most important about this? That can be a challenging question in that it's difficult to answer. They have to go inside. They have to reflect. They have to prioritize and categorize and do all these mental processes. That's a challenge. And I think everyone's pretty okay with that challenge. But then you can go a little further along that continuum of challenge. What if you did nothing? Oh, well, that's a little bit more kind of what we would think of as kind of classically provocative, right? Because it's sort of a bit counterintuitive, and it makes them grapple with something a little bit. It can seem a bit like it's poking them in a very caring way. So I think that a lot of coaching actually works by challenging your client. If you're not challenging your client, it's hard for me to imagine you're being a good thought partner, that your client's deriving much benefit at all, unless you're doing some form of challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. And related to this for me is like interrupting clients as well. You know, like I can, when you wrote about that, I could really relate to myself in the kind of internal ethical struggle I have around interrupting or not. You know, so because I really recommend people check out your book, because some of the kind of chapters will resonate more depending on where you're at or what type of person you are. And this one for me was one where I was like, okay, yeah, there's definitely moments where I can feel I'm kind of like leaning into not interrupting, but it doesn't feel right, you know? And so there's something for me to reflect on there.
This, yeah, I admit, is one of the more challenging ones for people, because it runs so counter to most cultural norms around politeness and most assumptions about good listening or active listening, although I think it puts the active in active listening. So let's just think about what an interruption is. Interruption basically is overlapping speech, right? Two people speaking at the same time. And you as a coach, not just you, Joel, but all your listeners interrupt constantly. And already people are going to say, what? That's not true. I'm a great listener. I'm always quiet. I give my clients space, all that kind of stuff. Sure. But if you say, mm-hmm, while your client's speaking, that is an interruption. Like, you just spoke at the same time as they did. And yet we don't somehow perceive that as an interruption. If your client's talking and you say, yeah, or great, or wow, those are interruptions. But somehow we feel they're more benign. We maybe sugarcoat them. Well, that's an interjection, not an interruption, right? But a rose by any other name, right? So I think when you start thinking, well, what are your cultural norms for interruption? Do you believe in turn-based speaking where Joel has to say 100% of everything he's going to say and then signal to me somehow that he's done? And then I get a turn and I get to say 100% of what I'm going to say. That mostly isn't how a lot of conversation happens in real life. You do say, you sometimes say, you know, if someone says, guess what? You sometimes blurt out a snarky little funny answer. You sometimes have a side conversation in a team meeting while someone is giving a presentation. Like all of those are forms of interruption that are really relatively common and accepted even. So sorry for the big answer, but now we've arrived at why would that be good in coaching? And I think it's good to sort of pounce on the important thing as it happens. So it can be a bit disconcerting to a client to tell you a huge story and they're talking, 5 minutes goes by, they're providing all the context, they're telling it to you in sequential order. Then it's your turn to talk and you say, I'd like to go back to something that you said 5 minutes ago. And I think that can feel really dismissive to a client. Like, why did I just say all that if that's what you're going to ask about? And so sometimes you just jump in like, oh, Joel, I'm sorry. Did you hear what you just said? Or, wow, that's an amazing thing to say. Do you mind if we linger on that point for a second? Or, oh, Joel, do you mind if I jump in? That sounds so important. And in fact, when you look at the ICF, core competencies and how they assess core competencies, interruptions, according to that rubric, are totally acceptable when you present your rationale for doing so. So, wow, Joel, this sounds so important. Do you mind if I jump in and ask about it? It is very caring for you. It is making you part of the conversation, giving you the ability to say, no, don't jump in, or yes, jump in. So I think it allows you to grab a moment without letting it pass.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And I've found with coaches and in my own coaching, I own my leadership in an interruption. It's in service of something, you know, it's in service of that moment. Then it tends to land really well. You know, it's like, whoa, let's just pause a moment. And whereas if, you know, if it's coming in with hesitation, then
there can be, I really like that. There can be kind of, and in fact, this was just an interruption. I just started speaking over the end of your thing, but hopefully that didn't feel bad to you. There can be a kind of confidence in it. And I'm reminded of the late David Peterson, who experimented with interruptions. He was just like, how many times could I interrupt in a row before it steps on my client's toes? And I can't remember the specific number, but it was more than one and it was more than two. And I think it was something like he could just interrupt three times in a row before a client was like, whoa, what's going on here? And what I think is one of the critical things to remember is when people perceive something as an interruption is one, when it is off topic, it derails from what they want to talk about. Or two, when you take the turn to speak and you don't give it back. But if I interrupt and then hand the turn back to you quickly, so if I'm like, wow, Joel, that's really amazing, and then it's clearly back to you and your turn, you don't even log that as an interruption.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah, I want to kind of like make sure we can get through a few of the provocations that I you know, that's why I like doing these podcasts, because I get to talk with people about this stuff that really, you know, hits me. And one of the things you wrote, which I liked as well, was coaching culture itself is an impediment to great coaching, which I thought was a really provocative statement. And you know, I on the podcast we've explored a lot around how, for example, our coaching competencies actually getting in the way of great coaching? Or, you know, as coaching becomes as matures and becomes more defined and professionalized, what gets lost? You know, so, well, I wonder if you could just speak into like why you wrote that phrase. Yeah.
Well, in part because I think there is, give me a second. I think every profession has its own vulnerabilities, right? I think, for example, if you're a prosecuting attorney, over time you can develop sort of a prosecuting mindset, right? And you sort of look at that and it makes you perhaps less compassionate for the defense side. Now, that's not an indictment of prosecuting attorneys. I'm saying that there is a potential hazard in adopting a singular mindset for a period of time. And I think we also have this. And that is, we know a lot about change and growth. And so then we just assume that we're masters of change and growth. But the meta conversation here is, well, how have you fundamentally changed your assumptions about change and growth? Or do you just feel like you figured out change and growth, which is not very growth oriented? So the dogmatism, I think, is a huge peril. I also think that coach training is interesting because we know very little about how it works. There are very few studies on coach training, the mechanisms by which people learn coaching. So there's a school of thought, for example, that you sort of teach people with training wheels, like do it exactly like this, never ask why. And then later, when you're super experienced, we're going to bring you behind the curtain and reveal to you that occasionally it's fine to ask why. That really, you know, it's kind of like taking the driver's test. You know, you've got to do it by the book. But then later, we'll teach you that sometimes you roll through a stop sign or you turn without using your signal or you speed a bit or whatever it is. And then there's another school of thought that says, why don't you just show them what real driving looks like? Why don't you show them an instance where a coach actually just kind of gives a piece of advice? And is that terrible? Does it work? Is it bad? And let them grapple with that. And we don't know which of those approaches is better, or if one is better. And so I think that we just need to be humble, maybe, about how much we know for such a nascent profession. Like, we're just barely figuring this stuff out, even though I'm quite proud of how much we have arrived.
You know, I think of people like David Drake, who's also writing about coaching maturity and, you know, challenging some of the ideas around competencies, for example. And like this, the whole flavor of the conversation I have is like, again, like what are some of the ingrained principles or tenets that we've just taken and we haven't questioned them at all? And like, I don't know what you think about this, but I mean, this I actually was not my own. I've got to give a nod to Peter Lindbergh, who is a philosophical counselor, and I've been doing some sessions with, I did a session with him, and I actually learned a lot from being with him. And he's writing about the coaching industry from a philosophical perspective. And one of the things he brought in, which I really appreciated and reflected on, was you know, the kind of impulse in coaching to be around success, you know, like in some ways it's like baked in, it's helping people become more successful, even if that success is defined in fairly sophisticated and, you know, wholesome ways. And so and he was kind of writing about philosophical counseling as being guided by the move towards wisdom, becoming wiser. And I really like that, you know, and I like the contrasting. Well, what if coaching was about that too? And I think a lot of coaching actually is about that or has that impact. But just, you know, just surfacing those core kind of values baked in a whole field.
I love what you're saying. I love pointing out wisdom, and I love you sharing about Peter Lindbergh as well. So when you very first asked me how has your coaching kind of changed in the last 18 months, or what are the influences? And I said, oh, I'm with all these kind of, really thoughtful people. I didn't want to name drop and say David Drake, but David Drake lives here in town. So he and I get together sometimes. And it's amazing to talk to him. And I definitely wouldn't put a novice coach with 1 week of experience in front of him because he's saying these kinds of things, He's, I mean, really, like, what makes for a coach? Like, what is the distance? Like, is a coach a guide? And we're supposed to, I mean, I understand we're supposed to say, no, a coach is in no way a guide because it's always a client-led agenda. I mean, I understand what the standard answer is, but we're trying to build on the standard answer. And what does a guide do? And is there part of coaching that embodies some of that? And I think those are really rich and interesting conversations. How is wisdom transferred? Can it be transferred through questions? How is the coach's philosophical underpinnings acting as a de facto directiveness in their coaching? I mean, these are, I think, pretty advanced questions for coaches. I wouldn't bake them into my intro coaching skills course, but though these are once you have your feet in the water and you've been practicing a couple of years, I think this is what you ought to be thinking about.
Yeah, a lot of coaches I know are really, and David is someone I speak to too, are actually even kind of thinking about the word coach and what is the work I'm doing and does coaching as a paradigm fit anymore? And, coaches who are doing something that looks like coaching and therapy, trained to be able to work in those areas. But so I find that fascinating because I think it reflects on our times and what's being called for and what's emerging. And so, just something you said about the kind of agenda of a coach as well. I really liked how you wrote about that in your book as well, because that's another one of these kind of sacred cows, that we follow the agenda of the client. And, as you just named now and you write about, it's like we do have our own agendas, and to kind of just think you don't have one, I think is limiting. And, just, and that's why I want to volley it to you in a second, but just something, it tapped in something I was talking about earlier actually, which was someone posed this to me: what experience do you want to be having as a coach, Joel? And this is in response to what I'd been sharing earlier about, like, I just noticed my coaching, it wasn't right at its edge how it can be, and I was getting a little bit complacent. And they were like, "What? Well, where are you in this? Like, what experience do you want to be having?" And I was like, "Yeah," and it opened up a whole lot, and it changed my coaching almost overnight, really. But it, so yeah.
How do you think that changed your coaching?
Because it immediately brought me into a reflect. Well, first of all, why has my coaching, what's happened in my coaching? Like, why am I even bringing this up? Like, oh, okay. Oh yeah, there's this feeling I get. So what it led me into is like, there's a feeling I get, and when I'm in that place, then I'm in my genius, and that's when the clients get the most from me. And that feeling has kind of died away a bit. Why is that? And so on, and so it led me actually into the next coaching session. I could feel how that feeling was guiding me, and basically how I'd moved away from my own sovereignty in a sense by absorbing someone else's amazing training, which has deep, what I would refer, it has deepened my coaching immeasurably. And it was like, oh, it's time now for you to make this completely your own again, which I think periodically we have to do as coaches is kind of stop training for a moment and just kind of let the dust settle and, yeah, kind of define that container that we create.
Wow. And sovereignty is such a great word to describe it. So interesting. I love it. It's funny because we talk about co-creation and coaching is a co-created experience. But I think for earlier career coaches, what that translates to is again these sort of platitudes, like it's all for the client. I have no expertise. I'm beginner's mind. I'm just accepting and supportive. I'm never interrupting. It's almost like you're not even there. But you're a real human who can be offended, and you have feelings, and you have thoughts, and you have opinions about what your client's saying. And what you do with that is a good conversation, because some of it you should probably check. Some of it's probably unconsciously biasing you. Some of it's probably overt and helpful to the client. And thinking through all that is good, because you are part of the co-created relationship. You're not absent to it. And I just feel like that the coach side of the equation isn't getting its due, I think, in some ways.
This kind of brings up for me bringing in the coach, because I think this is something that a lot of coaches feel is it's all about you, the client. I shouldn't bring myself in really, and we'll just follow you. And of course, there's a real wisdom in. I'm not just kind of sharing my own life stories all the time in response to what comes up, and it's a kind of form of advice giving. But actually, and this is what my question is, like, what do you think is the role for? Because I found like if I share myself in the moment, what it's like to be with the client, what's coming up for me, that also can drop the coaching into some incredible places.
Absolutely.
Oh,
Yeah, because you really are having a legitimate experience, and sharing that experience can provide good feedback to the client. Here's the thing that I is one of the things that I most often get criticized about when people see me coach, and I do, some public coaching demos. Sometimes a client will be talking, and I'll in reaction say, "Oh, that's really cool." And people don't always love that. They're like, "Robert, that's a judgment. That's your evaluation. You could potentially make the client dependent on your approval." I think those are fair considerations. I would view those as legitimate cautions. And I should, in my own reflective practice, think about that and notice that. Is the client doing pleasing behavior? What is their reaction when I say that? How frequently am I doing that? But I think it stopped short of, "Robert, you shouldn't do that." Because the truth is, I'm a real person having a real legitimate reaction when I see something that seems cool. I'm saying it's cool. And I also believe in my client sovereignty. I don't believe that I am such a powerful force in their life that if I say that's cool, they're going to be like, "Now I'm changing everything because Robert endorsed it." I just don't think that that's built in, although I think at the most extreme, I should be cautious of that. And so that is just an example of what you're talking about. If we share ourselves, we should just do it in a reflective way. Did it work? Did it work with this person? Would it work in general? Those are the kinds of questions I think that are more helpful than should we or shouldn't we?
I mean, it brings up a reflection on personality in coaching and the place for that, because as you as a beginner and you train in a way, you're training out of your personal habits and just having a normal, in inverted commas, conversation. But then, it just seems like, because we don't want a kind of sterilized, uber sterilized interaction and stuff. Maybe I'm being a bit unfair in a kind of possible way it could go, but
Well, this is another one of those tensions. And ultimately, I think grappling with tensions is what makes for masterful coaching. I mentioned before that I think a tolerance of uncertainty and don't feel like you've got it figured out is what separates great coaches from good coaches. And I think the other thing is, I understand that there's tensions. There's not just one thing. So early in your career, you just learned to coach. There is, whether you realize it or not, an inherent tension between, on the one hand, I need to be authentic. I'm really just me with my unique strengths, my sense of humor, my sense of emotional effusiveness, my personality. And on the other hand, I need to sort of be all things to all people. I need to meet the client where they are and sort of, you know, just this idea that I'm almost this chameleon, which doesn't fit well with this authentic idea. I don't know that I, Joel, have the answer to this tension, but I can tell you that when I train coaches, I lean towards the former and not the latter. I say, you don't have to be all things for all people. I love to refer prospective clients out to people who I think will be a better fit for them. I just think people who come in for the Robert experience, they're hiring not just a set of coaching skills, they're hiring me because typically they want to be a little bit challenged. They want kind of a faster paced, pretty heady cognitive kind of approach. I'm not like a warm hug. People don't find me, you know, super like, yeah, hey, like, you know, just this kind of like warmth. They feel safe with me because they feel that I'm professional and ethical. But you know, that's not going to work for everyone. Some people want a slower pace. They want more overt compassion. And I would be happy to send them to someone who's not me for that.
Yeah, yeah. That's great to reflect on. And I get that. And actually, you know, I found some of my most interesting coaching interactions to be with people that wouldn't. So this is when I've coached in programs in the past and in organizations where you don't select your client, you know, where you kind of, someone matches you with a client. And I used to be challenged by that because, yeah, you're meeting people that wouldn't normally work with you. And I found that to be an incredible training ground because I have a slower style. I like to kind of move into an embodied experience. So when I'm working with cognitive people, they're like, you know, they want pace and results. And exploring that tension has been incredibly rich, you know, because the way they are and their style starts to show up with me. And sometimes it has a, you know, it has a kind of, how can I put it? This is a powerful learning edge for them and how they show up in the world. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the example you give because for many of them, probably your slowing down and modeling that is really helpful for them, right? So you're rounding them out just with your own way of being. But there's also probably some limit for some people that's just not going to work, right? And so understanding like, where's that threshold?
Yeah. And me playing in the space with them as well. So, yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. Interesting.
There's a couple of questions I have about, I didn't read these chapters. I didn't get around to them, but I want to ask you anyway, because why are we not better at observing coaching? I wanted to ask you about that because I just find that provocative.
Yeah. You know, this gets to the self-enhancement bias, right? Like we all think that we're better than average at everything. And people might know the Dunning-Kruger curve where people who are novices think they're even way better because they don't know enough about the thing to judge how good they are at it. And I was once talking with Justin Kruger from the Dunning-Kruger effect. And Justin said, one of his favorite findings was that people think that they're better than average at using a computer mouse. And I'm like, do you have an eighth button on your mouse that you're doing? Like, what could you be doing that the rest of us are not doing? Like, how good are you at this computer mouse? So I think this also applies to observing coaching. I think we're like, I get coaching, I have a vocabulary for it, I have expert frameworks, I see what's happening. when I plateaued for the longest period of time in my professional career, the thing that got me out of it was becoming better at watching coaching and observing coaching. And the two ways that I did that is I quit coaching in my own head alongside, right? So there's a tendency to be like, oh, Joel, come on, the client's giving you a metaphor. Pick up the metaphor and use the metaphor. It's right there in your face. And I realized I was doing that, but I was just sort of doing the silent coaching. And I actually wasn't watching what you, Joel, were doing as the coach. And I'm not learning from how I would coach because I already know how I would coach. And so I had to quiet that chatter and just be like, what's Joel doing? What's Joel doing? Why is he not doing the metaphor? Clearly, I know he sees the metaphor, but he's choosing not to. What can I learn from that? And so getting out of my head and just being more receptive to what the coach was doing was a huge step forward for me. And also getting out of kind of a core competency mindset, like, oh, I see that they're demonstrating this skill and that skill and that skill, and into a sort of an interesting moments kind of thing. Like, it's kind of a long period of silence. I wonder how that was for the client. I wonder how comfortable the coach is with silence. I wonder if they've changed their comfort level with silence over time. And I wonder how they might have done that. And those are the types of things now that I'm noticing. And I notice far more specific things as when I observe coaching. So I'll notice that the coach parts their lips and I'm like, oh, they're about to speak. And then they shut their lips. They were about to say something and they chose not to. Wow, what was going on there? That's the stuff I'm trying to look for, because that to me is what's interesting, these, you know, multitude decisions that we're making in every minute of coaching.
Kind of like a connoisseurship of the transformational moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I love it. You're giving me lots of these sovereignty, connoisseurship of the transformational moment. You've got a good turn of phrase. I love it.
Thank you. Thank you. I take that. Yeah, so maybe then you could say something about great coaching, because I think we've been talking, this whole conversation is about that. And, you know, this last topic as well of like observing great coaching and or other coaches and reflecting about that. Do you have a sense of what kinds of things can help coaches? And in a way, like how, what do we mean by great coaching as well? We're assuming that thing for a start.
For me, I think intellectual humility might be a way to describe it, but it is that sense of uncertainty and the openness to uncertainty. When I interact with the coaches, and they typically have, you know, lots of experience, they've handled very complicated cases, they're, you know, the kind of people that you're like, wow, you know what you're doing. But they all come across as, yeah, and then there was this time I just wasn't sure what to do, or I'm still asking myself questions, and just this sense that I don't have it all figured out. Like, yeah, I'm really good at this, I have a lot of skills, but I'm still trying to figure out some of the basics. I heard a coach recently say, I'm not certain of anything in coaching. And I was like, wow, that's a big statement. Even though if you ask this coach, they would also say, oh no, I know how to ask a terrific question. But you know, they're just kind of getting it like, well, how is this working? I'm not sure that my assumptions about how coaching is working is how coaching is working. And I find that very different than people who are at the beginning of their career, or unfortunately, sometimes even people who, you know, have 10, 15 years in, and they're like, I just, you know, I 10 times all my clients' revenue and I'm amazing. And I just am so skeptical of that. But maybe they're good coaches, and maybe being a good coach is good enough. But I doubt that they embody coaching greatness.
I mean, there is that going on in the industry as well, you know, like a kind of, we talked about this with Wendy, and we did a podcast about ethics and coaching, and, you know, people kind of embellishing or cherry picking moments, which, okay, of course, it's fun to name your successes as a coach. But yeah, you're pointing to a certain kind of sensibility and humility, which I feel is important.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that coach who I just referenced doesn't mention the client companies that they work with. And I think, wow, that's pretty interesting to consider. I find it inspiring in a way, right? That they're not saying like, oh, look at me, I've worked with, Apple or Microsoft or, all these, Fortune 500 companies. They're just kind of saying like, I'm really going to be thoughtful. That's my value. I'm going to really be here with you and be thoughtful about this. And I think that there is a real temptation, especially given social media, to be inflationary. And I think that people often aren't even aware that they're inflating. And there's a difference between marketing as I'm trying to place my wares in public view so that if you want them, you know they're here. And this kind of inflationary approach that's saying, I'm somehow trying to persuade you or coax you or convince you that you want this thing, which feels a bit different to me qualitatively.
Yeah. I mean, that is another, that's a provocative kind of inquiry, really, isn't it? Where might one be leaning too far into inflation or sensationalizing something? And what does one do about that? Or how does one market yourself in a way that feels authentic and ethical?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give you a quick example of this that I often share with people. I knew a coach one time, and to protect anonymity, I'll just say that I knew that they had worked in two different countries, and I usually say let's call it Canada and South Africa. But online, what they said is from Canada to South Africa, I have a wide range of international coaching experience. And so in some ways, it's technically correct, right? There is a factual basis to it, but it's also to me knowingly misleading because it is suggestive of more experience. And so I would question, like, what is the desire to sort of hint at all this extra stuff in the gaps rather than just this, like, really to the core authenticity? Like, here's who I am, this is what I offer, and you can take it or leave it if it's a good fit for you, right? Or not.
I want to just sort of, there's another question that could like be a final question that we might take some time to explore into. But so just one thing I want to underline throughout this whole conversation is like coaches actually doing this reflection, really, the like taking the time to reflect on one's practice and consider some of these, these axioms, these principles that one holds, without questioning, and kind of engaging in a kind of open mindset, and kind of connecting with other coaches, seeing other coaching, that just feels like a strong, really powerful theme throughout the whole conversation, which I just think is worth naming again because I, for example, supervision, if I put my hand up, I'm like, yeah, I engage in supervision periodically. I don't know, maybe a lot of coaches don't at all, but yeah, actually, when I ethically consider how much I care about this art of coaching, I'm not doing it enough, So I think these are really important questions.
Yeah, and on the ethics point, I just spoke with both psychologists and coaches and said, like, how often are you having discussions around ethical dilemmas? Just something came up in my practice. I'm not sure how to handle it. I don't know what the boundaries are here. Just, and basically the response I got is you should be doing it, I heard everywhere from kind of, I think around like 6 months or 6 weeks to 3 months. But that is, you should be having in-depth conversations about real case scenarios that are happening to you or another person pretty regularly. And if you're not, you're not doing it enough. And you might not even be recognizing that it's coming up, right? So you, I've had a maybe four such conversations so far this year. So we're about, you know, just past 6 weeks into the year, and I've had four pretty in-depth ethical conversations. And I feel like it's going to the gym and flexing my muscles so that I'm constantly thinking about what's ethical.
Just tell me about that. So you're engaging in those conversations with kind of peers or, you know, supervision about your own coaching practice and what's coming up, or is it about the wider coaching field? Yeah.
It's both. So it might be something that's wider coaching. Like, I saw someone advertising something the other day, and it just sort of, I don't know, kind of rubbed me the wrong way. And I'm trying to figure out why that is. What do you all think about this?
Yeah.
Right? Because we, because part of coaching ethics is we all bear responsibility for the reputation of coaching. It's not just about protecting your client. It's also about protecting coaching. And so I had a conversation about that. And sometimes it also is something having to do with my own practice, right? Am I getting complacent here? One of mine was, I made a bold claim to a client that kind of offended them a little bit. Like, I could just see it rubbed them the wrong way. And I didn't have any appreciation that that would have happened. And so I was surprised by it. And so then I just wanted to get a couple of my colleagues, like, what do you think about that? And I'm fine for them to say, like, yeah, it was probably too risky. You shouldn't have done it. Or you should have been more aware going in that that was a potential downside to this. And I'm okay. Like, I'm fine to hear that.
Yeah. 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 Thanks for sharing that. Yeah. Then let me ask my last question, which is, now I'm formulating it as I put myself on the spot, but
take your time.
What like, there's two questions inside of this. Like, what moves you most inside your coaching? So that's a very nebulous kind of question, really, but I'll trust you just to take that however it comes. And what most excites you at your edge of your coaching these days? So
I really think about the tone of coaching, and I distinguish personally between what's serious and what's important. So I think serious is a tone. It's kind of somber, like, oh, I'm sorry that happened. That sounds like a big deal. You know, my heart goes out to you for the distress you're experiencing, versus what's important, which is, this sounds like a major deal in your life, but we don't have to treat it seriously. We could joke about it. I could tease you about it. You could laugh about it. We could have fun with it. And I am capable of being serious because sometimes it's called for, but I always want it to be important. But I don't think that important leads to serious. So the coaching sessions I have that feel the best to me are important, but not serious. That is, the client feels relaxed. They're joking. They're saying things off the cuff. We're doing callback humor, you know, to something earlier that happened in the session. They're like, there I go again, or whatever. And yet it's making progress, and it's treating the thing as if it is crucial, as if it is linked to their values, as if it has real world impacts. And that feels good to me. And I think it feels good to the client as well.
And just before you answer the second part of the question, or the second question, I can imagine that's actually, you're modeling something important for me there, which is, you know, we can take ourselves very seriously, can't we? And yeah, that's not to deny some things that happen to us are kind of serious and really important. But we can take ourselves, I mean, you know, I can take myself really seriously. So to have somebody modeling like this is important, but I'm gonna like play, we're gonna play with this a little bit, and then that frees you up suddenly. So
Yeah, I'll give you a quick example of a client that I had relatively recently, but it was just straight organizational coaching, thinking about, all the kinds of things that you might be thinking about, team dynamics, restructuring, blah, 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 like all just classic organizational coaching. And two sessions in a row, as we wrapped up, the client was sort of like, wow, that really worked. Wow, that was really helpful. And I frankly, I just kind of teased him. I was like, I'm just absolutely tickled that you are surprised every single time that this was effective. Like, I just cannot imagine like going into the doctor and being like, turns out that penicillin works. Turns out when you did surgery, like you actually pulled the thing out or whatever. Like, and yet, like time and time again, this client was like, huh, that really worked. And I was like, what did you think was going to happen? Like, what are you walking into these sessions with? And to me, and he thought it was funny that I was teasing him about that. And that just felt so good and relaxed that we could have that interaction. And it felt so kind of real and authentic rather than, kind of being like, do you feel complete? Is this a good place to end? I'm glad. Good luck to
and it reveals something to him, doesn't it? It's a nice way of like him, like, oh, okay, yeah, I am saying those things. What's going on in me,
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, just that, like, I don't know, just to speak for a moment into like what, what's on the edge for your coat, what excites you? Yeah.
I mean, I know people want me to just say like, oh, AI or team coaching or whatever these kind of fads are. I don't know. The truth is, really just asking these fundamental questions, like writing the book Positive Provocation felt so good to me because it felt like that's my mission, just to like ask questions and have people wrestle with them, regardless of whether they agree with me or not agree with me. And when I hear that people are like doing it as a book club or like that feels great. Like, ah, that's what I want to have happen. And more than my coaching practice, I want to have just some engagement around coaching in general and the culture of coaching. I want coaching to be as great as possible.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I really feel that. Yeah, so it's been amazing to have you on, Robert, and just appreciate the provocation, the care, actually, the care in your provocation. That's what really stands out for me. So, yeah, where can we find out more about your work and the book and things like that?
Well, the book Positive Provocation, it's available everywhere. You can see my personal website. That's robertdiener.com, Diener. And my coach training is at positiveacorn.com.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I really had fun.
Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.